WBUR, Boston, Cape Cod, and the Islands, and on the web at WBUR.org.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. The Sean Bell case in New York has thrown a big spotlight on American big city police and policing. An unarmed man on the morning of his wedding day, no crime, no offense, cut down in a hail of 50 police bullets. And last week, all officers cleared in the case. Peter Moskos is watching closely. The Harvard-trained sociologist spent a year on the beat as a cop on the toughest streets of Baltimore. Now he's telling what he saw, the heroism and the madness. Up next, On Point, out of the ivory tower and into the squad car, we're on the beat and in the heat with Peter Moskos. First, this news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Carl Kessel. The economy expanded by a modest 0.6% annual rate in the first quarter of 2008. Most economists had predicted today's Commerce Department report would show a slide into recession, but high business inventories due to a slower consumer spending growth kept that from happening. The anemic growth rate may be revised twice in the coming weeks, and economist Bernie Baumol of the Economic Outlook Group believes that despite today's figures, the economy is actually in a recessionary environment. He says it will be a while before the situation improves.
When you put it all together, we're really talking about three of the most important sectors of the economy that are now dragging business activity down. Housing is one of them, financial services is the other, and consumer spending is the third. There is no way that this economy can gain any traction so long as those three sectors are out of action.
Today, the Federal Reserve is to make an announcement about interest rates. Many economists expect another rate cut with the goal of stimulating the economy. General Motors is reporting a $3.3 billion loss for the first quarter. From Michigan Radio, Dustin Dwyer reports.
GM took a nearly $1.5 billion hit from its minority ownership in the GMAC lending company, and it took a $700 million hit helping its former parts subsidiary Delphi emerge from bankruptcy. Once those charges are out of the way, GM's loss adds up to $350 million. That's still 35 times worse than the same quarter last year. GM's automotive operations improved overseas, but there are still big problems in North America. Sales are down, and the company also had to cut production because of an ongoing strike at a parts supplier. For NPR News, I'm Dustin Dwyer in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
The leaders of the two main parties in Pakistan's coalition government are meeting in Dubai today as they attempt to resolve their first big disagreement. The talks are being closely watched in Pakistan for signs that the coalition could be disintegrating. NPR's Philip Reeves reports.
Pakistan's one-month-old government is still savoring its sweeping election victory, but it's already run into turbulence. Its two main coalition parties disagree over restoring dozens of judges sacked by President Pervez Musharraf in November. The party leaders, Asif Zardari, who's Benazir Bhutto's widower, and former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, have a signed agreement that by today they'll ask Parliament to restore the judges. The deadline's arrived, and the judges are still waiting. Sharif says he wants the judges restored at once, including the sacked Chief Justice. Zardari says this should be part of a package of constitutional reforms. This is an emotive issue in Pakistan. Musharraf's moves against the Chief Justice early last year led to a political crisis and street protests by lawyers. Philip Reeves, NPR News, Islamabad.
This is NPR News.
Good morning, I'm Steve Brown in Boston. Youth peace activists, along with city and community leaders, are gathered this morning in Dorchester to mark the start of Boston's annual Peace Month. WBUR's Shannon Mullen is there.
State and city lawmakers, Suffolk County's district attorney, victims of violence, former teen criminals, and peace activists. Speaker after speaker at today's event praised the coming Peace Month as an important time to focus on fighting violence in Boston. But they called for that fight to continue year-round, saying peace is more than just the absence of violence. Organizers also showed a video of inmates sharing peace messages for urban teens, including an apology from Anthony Warren, whose stray bullet paralyzed Kylie Harriet in Dorchester nearly 5 years ago. Her forgiveness, Warren said in the tape, has given him a second chance. For WBUR, I'm Shannon Mullen in Dorchester.
The City of Boston today opens an emergency center at City Hall to serve residents and businesses affected by the water main break that disrupted natural gas service to the financial district in North End. Hundreds of customers remain without gas service. Several restaurants who have not been able to serve food since the weekend estimate tens of thousands of dollars in lost business. DNA tests performed by University of Massachusetts medical research team have proved that bone fragments pulled from the Ural Mountains belong to two children of the last Tsar of Russia. Tsar Nicholas II and his family were murdered in 1918 as the country descended into civil war. The remains of Nicholas, his wife Alexandra, and three of their daughters were unearthed in the same region back in 1991. In sports, the Celtics play Game 5 of their first-round playoff series with the Hawks tonight over at the Garden. That series is tied 2 games apiece. In the forecast, mostly sunny and breezy today. The highs will be around 58 degrees. Clear and cool tonight. Lows around 41. Sunshine through some increasing afternoon high clouds tomorrow. The highs around 62 degrees. Right now, 48 degrees in Boston. This is WBUR.
WBUR supporters include First Giving, helping people raise money for any charity for any reason or occasion through online fundraising. More on how to get started at firstgiving.com. And iShares, let's build a better investment world, on the web at iShares.com/betterworld.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Sociologist Peter Moskos wanted to study big city police. To do it, he became one, a cop in Baltimore. He spent over a year in blue patrolling Baltimore's toughest streets. This week, with the Sean Bell case in New York, the country's thinking about police and policing. Good cops, bad cops, who lives, who dies. Peter Moskos has plenty to say, and don't get him started on the war on drugs. This hour, On Point, a midnight ride with policeman sociologist Peter Moskos. You can join the conversation. Do you think you know Baltimore's mean streets from HBO's The Wire? What's your question for the sociologist who's walked the beat about how police think and act and why? And police, let us hear from you. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Peter Moskos. He teaches law, police science, and criminal justice administration at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York. In 1999, while working on his Ph.D. at Harvard, he attended the Baltimore Police Academy for 6 months and then spent 14 months in uniform full-time as a rookie cop on the city streets. He's out with a new book in just a couple of weeks called Cop in the Hood, My Year Policing Baltimore's Eastern District. Peter Moskos, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. And let me say first, we know your father, Charles Moskos, well. We talked a lot with him early in the Iraq War about troop levels and much more there. He is and was a very wise guy for us. And he
was against the war from the beginning, which most people can't say.
Indeed. And I understand he's had a couple of health issues lately, but we wish him the very best. And please pass
Thanks.
That to him if you would.
So
take us in here. How did you get from ivory tower to squad car? You set out to do some research. Somewhere along the way, they said, you can't just come and watch us. You want to be here. You've got to be one of us.
Well, originally my plan was just to sort of do a egghead sociology dissertation, and I tried to do it in Boston, and they said no. I tried to do it in New York, and they wouldn't return my phone calls, and Baltimore said yes initially. So I went down there in the fall of 2000, and for reasons I didn't really understand at the time, but there was a politics involved. The old commissioner, Thomas Frazier, was out, and the new brass didn't like him. And so my research got disapproved on day two of the academy, and I had a rather awkward meeting with the acting commissioner. And he said, well, why don't you become a cop for real? And I said, well, who's going to hire me knowing that I am going to quit after a year, though I ended up staying longer,
yeah.
and write a book about it? And he said, well, I would. If you can get hired, I'll hire you. So I went through the hiring process in the first month of the police academy, which is a little unusual. And was hired in a record time of 6 weeks, and then was a fully paid member of the Baltimore Police Department.
And out you went onto the streets of the Eastern District, and we need you to tell us about those.
I mean, I love you quote right in the front of the book, Clint Eastwood, Dirty Harry, 1971, talking to his partner, that just what I needed is a college boy. What's your degree? Sociology? And there you are. I mean, and then you quote a sergeant in the Eastern District, you know, I mean, you know, he's got a good sense of humor here. He knows where you're from. And he says, okay, do you find yourself being slowly sucked into the oppressive right-wing conspiracy? They had your number.
That sergeant was a bit of a character. He at one point, he asked me, oh, Moscow, tell me something about those Harvard professors of yours. And I, you know, policing in general is not the most intellectual field. And I said, well, you know, my advisor is this guy named Orlando Patterson. He's, oh, Patterson, my God, he's written some good stuff. And he had read his books that I hadn't read. So I felt a bit embarrassed about that. But in general, the welcome I got from the police was by and large, great. I mean, I was surprised how little flack I got for being a Harvard grad student. I got some flack for being sort of politically liberal, but that, I think, is just, you know, everyone gets some flack for something, and that was my thing.
Read us just a little bit from the opening chapter here about living in Baltimore City.
Sure. Living in Baltimore City, I was required to carry my gun both on and off duty. I never fired a shot outside of training. Only rarely was my service weapon, a charged semi-automatic 9mm Glock 17 with no safety and a 17-round clip, pointed at somebody. But in my police duties, my gun was very routinely removed from its holster, probably every other shift. I did occasionally chase people down alleys and wrestled a few suspects. I maced one person, but did not hit anybody. As a police officer, I tried to speak softly and carry a big stick. The department issued a 29-inch straight wooden baton just for this purpose. I brought it along to all my calls.
So this is not the ivory tower. It's Peter Moskos reading from Cop in the Hood about his year policing in Baltimore's Eastern District. You've got some big points in here, and we've got Sean Bell in the news out of New York. But let us just understand to begin with. I mean, you went there for research. You signed up for real. What did you make of it? Was it easy to stay on 14 months on the street? Did you think about doing it for longer, give up all that, you know, professorial stuff and live the nitty-gritty, or were you, how did you take to it or not?
I took to it fine. I don't think, I did not love it as much as some others, but I think I liked it, you know, more than some. I ended up quitting when I got civil service protection, because I was getting paid and it was a job. I figured I could stay, but once they couldn't fire me, I figured that was a good time to quit.
And what about the Sean Bell? We want to get into Baltimore, but all over the news, you know, just last Friday, there, of course, the case was 2006. Sean Bell was out at a strip club in Queens with a couple of buddies very early in the morning of his wedding day, famously, infamously. He went out to his car, got sort of chased down and into a scuffle, kind of, with some undercover detectives there. He ended up, 50 shots fired. He ended up dead, and last week those detectives, New York detectives Michael Oliver and Giscard Isnor and Mark Cooper, cleared of criminal liability here by the judge. You've been on the beat. What do you think of that?
I think it was a fair verdict. I think the problem is that we try to make these trials symbolize so much more than what they actually are, which is the criminal guilt of three defendants in this case. Clearly something wrong happened because an innocent man got killed.
Innocent, unarmed, not shooting, not firing, not barely fighting. I mean, you don't have to get up to the symbolic level to be a little disturbed by that, do you?
I'm more disturbed by other shootings that have happened, like Diallo or Zongo in New York City. I mean, Sean Bell did take some actions that led to him getting shot. That's not that he should have been shot or killed, but he did charge a police officer with his car. I'm happy I wasn't in that situation and never have been in that situation. Had I been, I don't know what I would have done because I wasn't there, but very likely I would have shot as well. The problem is the criminal trial tests the criminal guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. Having followed the trial, I had doubt.
You had doubt of what exactly?
I had doubt of their criminal guilt in this matter. Had I been the judge, I thought the judge issued a very good verdict. That being said, it's, you know, something, there's a greater issue here, but criminal trials don't address that issue. I mean, that's something that we as society have to do. We don't have any collective way to deal with these issues of police abuse, police use of force, proper and improper. For the police officers involved in the trial, I mean, it's still not over for them. There's probably going to be a civil trial, undoubtedly. There'll be departmental issues. So in terms of their, you know, lives and their careers are probably, you know, looking up for them right now. But I wish we could sort of talk about these issues in some way other than simply focusing on a criminal trial, because that's not what the trial is for.
Well, then paint it a little bigger for us. And what do you think happened here? I mean, he was innocent. He was unarmed, and he ended up dead. We don't want that to happen to American citizens.
No, and it seems to happen, it happens often to black men. And that is part of the problem it's good that we're talking about that. We have to address. But in the trial, Sean Bell wasn't on trial. Sean Bell did some things he shouldn't have done. Should not be a death penalty to
like
any
what?
Man.
Like what? Got drunk? Went to a strip club? Or
no, hell, that's all right. I got no problem with that.
Lots of guys do that before they get married.
Yeah, what he shouldn't have done is everyone in this situation, I think, to a certain extent, behaved rationally, and I think that's the problem. It reminds me of it's the Rashomon effect, the old Japanese movie where the same violent happening is viewed from different perspectives, and all the perspectives are true. The problem is they contradict. There is no single truth in this case.
But if you came out of a bar at night a little bit tipsy, or maybe a lot, and three undercover detectives are suddenly kind of really on top of you, I mean, you might not
have so coolly... And he may or may not have known they were police officers. Mm-hmm. He saw a black man with a gun and thought he was being robbed, perhaps, and then tried to get away. If I was Sean Bell, I would have done the same thing. That's what makes the case so tricky. Mm-hmm. Had I been Sean Bell, I might have done the same thing. Had I been a police officer, I might have done the same thing. The problem, of course, is that Sean Bell is now dead. And his friends are wounded, too. So these are issues that we have to talk about in training and in society. But the criminal trial is not the place for that. I mean, it's a place for something. Sean Bell wasn't on trial. It was these three officers.
And now Al Sharpton's talking a lot about it and saying New York's going to hear more about it, and it may not be over. We're going to come back and look at some of the nitty-gritty of policing in big urban streets in the United States, and at some of the big dynamics around policing that may have come to bear in Sean Bell's case, certainly dynamics that Peter Mosco saw on the street. His new book is Cop in the Hood, My Year Policing Baltimore's Eastern District. Harvard-trained sociologist who was all of a sudden a guy in blue out there for real, doing it rookie, full-time. You can join the conversation. What is your take on big city cops today? Friend or foe? Angry? Scared? Trigger-happy? Heroes? What's your question for a sociologist who's walked the beat? Do you know Baltimore's mean streets firsthand? Do you know them from the HBO series The Wire? Join us, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Peter Mosco, please stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
All the angels smile, about Jesus, my dear soul.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Liberty Mutual for auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual, responsibility, what's your policy? And Stonehill College, where many minds gather for one purpose, to educate students for lives that make a difference. Near Boston and Easton, Massachusetts, stonehill.edu.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station, and on the web at WBUR.org. It's 11:19. Coming up at noon, it's Here and Now with Robin Young. Food and gas prices are soaring, foreclosures continue, and the Bush administration says it's bringing back the one-year Treasury bill. Another sign the economy is in trouble. Also, we talk about making ends meet with several people today. Those stories and more on Here and Now, coming up at noon here on WBUR. In the forecast, mostly sunny and breezy today. The high is around 58 degrees. Clear and cool tonight, low around 41. Sunshine through some increasing afternoon high clouds tomorrow. The high is around 62 degrees. Right now, 48 degrees in Boston. This is WBUR.
WBUR supporters include Freelancers Union, a nonprofit group providing advocacy and dental insurance to qualified independent workers. More information at freelancersunion.org. And Weber Shandwick, combining local roots with global reach to provide strategic communications to New England companies and institutions. Weber Shandwick, advocacy starts here.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about what one Harvard-trained sociologist saw when he climbed out of the ivory tower and into the squad car, when he joined the police force in the city of Baltimore. My guest is Peter Moskos. His new book is Cop in the Hood, My Year Policing Baltimore's Eastern District. He was working on a PhD, needed to do some research, ended up in the police academy and actually in the force, in the uniform, in blue, on the streets. In the wake of the Sean Bell shooting and verdict in New York last week on the detectives who shot him, unarmed man, 50 bullets, all officers cleared, we want to know, we want to think about what's going on in the minds of cops. You can join the conversation. What's your question for a sociologist who's walked the beat, and policemen, women? Let's hear from you on Sean Bell, on Baltimore, on reality and your beat. We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Let's go right to somebody in blue. Jay's calling. Police officer, as I read it here, doesn't want to say where from. Jay, thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you, Tom.
Yeah.
And it's great to hear your guests talk about this. This is a very important issue.
Are you, in fact, a police officer, Jay?
Yes, for years.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, there's the radio.
We hear it. We hear it.
I've been for 8 years, and I've had to use deadly force, and I just wanted just your guest to expound upon how when a shooting event occurs, how the policing in general is put on trial. And that's something that I found in my incident, and I see it all too often when police have to use deadly force, because I want to put it that have to use because we don't want to.
What do you make of the Sean Bell case, the story, Jay?
They were in fear for their lives, and they used the force that they deemed necessary to defend themselves and others there. It's unfortunate that it happened. It's unfortunate that it went down, but as the judge said, that there was no, you know, there was reasonable doubt to say that they acted to, you know, with malice against Mr. Bell.
We'll put it to Peter Moskos, but I mean, for you as a policeman, I mean, anybody can understand a situation. It's at night. It's a tough neighborhood, maybe, and people get scared and in fear for their life. But as an American citizen, let me put it to you: should I be afraid that if I go out and have a drink, get tipsy, and then get freaked out by guys kind of bearing it down on me as I leave the bar? Should I have to be afraid that I'll be killed by cops?
No, I don't. I don't think you should be. If you have somebody that's coming, that's a police officer, and I kind of take. Cops, using the word cops.
Police officers. I take your point. It's right in his title, but I take your point.
If a police officer is acting in a proper, in a manner where they've identified themselves, and a person hops in their car and puts the gas on and they're in fear for themselves, then the police are going to act in a manner to defend themselves. Doesn't always mean shooting, but it could mean other things.
Peter Moskos, you hear Jay. He's right there in the car. You hear his radio at work, and he's had to use deadly force himself, and that cannot be any fun for anyone.
No.
What do you think of his observation?
I mean, luckily I never had to use deadly force, but I also think had I stayed on the force for longer, I probably would have. I mean, it was to a certain extent where I was policing, I felt it was just a matter of time. I mean, policing is unique in that it's one of the only jobs where you have to consider, you know, are you willing to kill somebody? Not that you want to, and it should go without saying, but it is important to remember, as Jay said, that, you know, no police officer puts on the uniform and wants to shoot somebody. It's the last thing you want to do. If you're in a situation, I mean, there was a very good op-ed in the New York Times recently by a retired Lieutenant Kyle Murphy, and he said, look, I'm willing to risk my life, but I'm not willing to gamble with it. And the first priority is to go home. And I think, you know, anybody would consider that a normal urge to have, to want to go home. When these events happen, you know, there's criminal matter, there's, you know, were departmental regulations followed. In the Sean Bell case in particular, I mean, I think the real shame is that the situation developed at all. I think plainclothes officers are overused. In this case, where you have a problem with the bar with, you know, issues, they're worried about drugs and prostitution and, I assume, neighbors' complaints. If you're worried about the quality of life issues, all you need is one uniform cop outside, and everything will be quiet outside.
Why do you think they wouldn't have done that? Why three undercover plainclothes cops, unmarked cars?
This unit itself was set up in Chelsea. There was a student killed outside of a nightclub in Chelsea, a part of Manhattan. And evidently, they did a very good job at whatever they were doing in Chelsea with these nightclubs. And instead, they should have perhaps disbanded the unit, given them all medals and awards, and said great things about them. But instead, they sent them off to Queens. And I think to a certain extent, yeah, this needn't have been undercover work. There's also, the unit was composed of a lot of narcotics officers, former narcotics officers, and I think to a certain extent that mentality showed. Narcotics is very geared towards making an arrest as opposed to keeping the peace. In this case, they could have stopped Sean Bill if they thought they was going to get a gun, because there was a bit of an altercation outside the club that led to this, where there was talk of a gun.
Right.
They could have stopped him right there. And then they could have searched the car. It would have been hard to press the charges because they would have said, it's not my gun, I don't know how I got in the car. But everyone would be alive.
But they went to the car because what? You're just speculating they might have thought that's where
I'm
drugs...
I'm speculating. Maybe they couldn't have stopped them earlier. I wasn't there. But, you know, backup hadn't come yet, so maybe you didn't want to make a stop before guys or something. But I think they wanted to make an arrest. And in that sense, they wanted to get him with the gun in the car. And that would have been a great arrest.
What about Jay's point that, you know, someone dies, police officers have to use deadly force, someone dies, and it's always the cops, the police officers, on trial. He doesn't like that. In our society, should we give
this... Cops are held to a higher standard, but the cops should be held to a higher standard. I mean, they're given a lot of responsibility in the sense they are armed and they're allowed to use deadly force, and they're also given a huge benefit of the doubt. They're allowed to make good faith errors. Cops are held to a higher standard. There's just no other way to put it. But, I mean, I think that's a good standard to hold police officers, and, you know, by and large, police live up to that higher standard.
Jay, Officer Jay, is that just something you've got to live with, the higher standard, or does it feel unfair?
No, I like the higher standard, and I expect that out of my fellow officers. A lot of times I see whenever there is a deadly force incident where... a police officer has to use deadly force, that police as a whole are placed on trial. And, might just be the situation, because of where I'm looking from at my vantage point. But it just seems like that too often is the case. And it's instead of looking at the big picture of the issues of what are going on in that area, or what was going on in that person's life or in that issue, we don't know all the circumstances. There's a lot of speculation and too much speculation when these incidents occur. And I think that's, it's sad. The news wants to put the story out quick. Things become cloudy and it's too bad. I understand where people want to know what happened and want to get all the answers.
Yep.
But at the same time, things get cloudy and muddy and a lot of speculation.
Yeah, we hear it both ways. Jay, thank you very much for your call and thanks for your service there. Peter?
It does, and often the New York City Police Department's held up. They're the ones to get the press because, in large part, the press is in New York. And, of course, there's no consolation to any person who's killed by police here, but on a sort of more grand level, I mean, the New York Police Department in general is statistically better. They don't shoot as many people. I mean, Baltimore City Police kill almost as many as New York City.
With a fabulously smaller city.
It's half as many, but it's less than one-tenth the population.
Mm-hmm.
There is a lot, and I think those are, by and large, justified shootings as well. It's a more violent city. But New York sort of bears an unfair amount of the spotlight.
And still,
by and large, they're a better than average police force.
Yeah, but Sean Bell is dead. We're going to turn to Baltimore. Let me get one more call right here on Sean Bell Joe in Columbia, South Carolina. Joe, you're on the air.
Yes. I'm insist about it. About his murder, sir. First of all, they use 50 bullets. I mean, that's way over. They tranquilize animals, sir. You don't need 50 bullets to kill no one. You don't need to. Whatever police officer shot this man, they need to, pump him with 50 rounds.
Mm-hmm.
That's what started to begin with. And second of all, Sometimes police make a mistake. What are your guests say something about Sean Bell must have done something wrong? I don't think Sean Bell done anything wrong. He might have went to a party or something.
Mm-hmm.
And from what I understand, he was going away from the police officer. The police officer's life was definitely not in jeopardy if he was going away from the police officer.
Mm.
I think this is wrong. I think the police officer should have been convicted, at least the one that did the shooting anyway. And I don't know about all three of them, but whichever one did the shooting, the
all three
animal shooting should have been convicted. I think if I was the Bell family, I would definitely appeal this verdict.
Yeah, Joe, thank you very much. Peter Moskos, Sean Bell's father, William Bell, asked after the verdict, said, you know, sort of, what is this? He said, is this 1955 Alabama? Now, Jay sees it differently. You're seeing it differently. But you hear Joe. He says, look, I'm incensed. 50 rounds? It shouldn't happen.
Yeah, I mean, and he should be incensed. The focus, I mean, because an innocent man got killed. The focus on the number of bullets, I think, is a sort of a police-public divide. Many, if not most people, are into the number of bullets fired. So maybe it is a big issue. As a former cop, to me, the issue isn't the 50. It's the first one. You can fire very quickly. I could fire 50 rounds in less than 15 seconds. Had I felt threatened for 15 seconds, I would have fired all 50 rounds that I had. The officer, yeah, he fired 31 rounds, but to me the issue is, why was the first one fired?
Hmm.
After that, I don't quite know what to say. After that, look, all the shooting lasted for I think less than 10 seconds.
It happens fast.
It wasn't a long period of time.
Hmm.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to say we're only going to give cops, you know, 6 bullets again, that's fine. But, you know, I don't want to go to the cop funeral, someone who runs out of ammunition.
Pull back the curtain for us a little bit here on what you learned about police culture in Baltimore. And I don't know how much is applicable right across the country in big cities or not. But there's a sense of what the sort of the police culture, police identity is. How did you see that going in, or how do you perceive how the public sees that, and what did you find is the origins of it? What's the culture behind the screen here?
Well, the first thing, the police call, I mean, by and large, I'd say it's a conservative working class culture. It's reflective of the environment that the police officers come from. That being said, but that sort of as an umbrella, the police department is incredibly diverse, and there's a certain irony that my police academy class was more diverse than any class I ever took in college. Real diversity, you know, not just a racial demographic that matches society. I mean, different
right.
views, different opinions, mm. different races. That is something I hadn't seen since, you know, since high school gym class.
Mm, yeah.
And in that sense, there's a certain tolerance behind the blue facade. There's a certain tolerance of people for who they are. That's why I think I was able to be accepted as a police officer. I heard a lot of, with the exact same words too, a lot of other officers said, you know, if you can use this as a stepping stone to something better, more power to you.
You go, man.
Yeah, I mean, then other people maybe had plans they wanted to transfer to a better paying department or go to the FBI. It didn't have to be your life's calling, and the fact that it wasn't mine, I think some held that against me. You know, one guy said, "Oh, you're not a," I forget the exact line. I think it's in my book. You're not a, you know, real cop. You're just using this to get a PhD. But that was not very common to hear that among police officers. There was also a culturally, which I think just reflects society, that there were different attitudes between black and white police officers.
Describe
by and large, a lot of the especially black women police officers, and my class had a record number of women in the academy class, took to the job to either do good, because they'd come from communities and they saw what crime had done to their communities.
Yep.
And they also came to the job because it was a good, stable job. All of the women in my academy class were mothers, by and large single mothers.
Mm-hmm.
And in Baltic, in some police departments you need college education, in Baltimore you don't. So given, if you have a high school diploma or a GED, what other job can you get that does give you the stability and the benefits, and to a certain extent the respect of, that being a police officer does? Among white police officers, there was a bit more of the sort of stereotypical, young white guys who wanted to be a cop for the action. It was, you know, they loved the TV show Cops. They wanted to get paid to carry a gun, and they came. There is not a residency requirement in Baltimore, so they came from the county, the surrounding suburbs, and had much less of a, you know, didn't have much dealings with the city before becoming a police officer.
You write that young police, you write, learn that the job has more to do with public control than public service. And we should explain what you mean by that, what you observed.
There's a shift in police when you go into the academy. Some believe it more than others, as I said, but everyone kind of gives lip service to, why are you doing this? Oh, I want to serve the community. By the time you're on the street, you'll learn that the job is not so much about serving the community. You shift your focus from the public to your fellow officers. The job is about safety. It's about getting along with your officers. And it's about dealing with the public more than serving the public. Police officers don't get called when things are going well. They don't see graduations and people coming home from work tired and going to bed. They get called when things are out of control, especially in the area where I policed, where there are a lot of things out of control there. It wears you down a bit. You get tired of telling the same idiots to get off the same corner night after night after night. And you realize, too, that to some extent, while you can do good as a police officer, and that's a good part of the job, and, you know, how many jobs could you have that chance to save people's lives? That being said, you know, Baltimore really wasn't a better city when I left than when I came there. And as a police officer, you have to accept the fact that you're not going to change the world. You're not going to win the war on drugs. Things are going to continue. So the best you can do is sort of, you know, you get by day to day.
You've got, you quote one officer here. I mean, this is a world in which political correctness is out the window. But there's a lot of ironic humor and a lot of awareness. And you're quoting a fellow officer talking about the people in your district. And he's saying, oh, they're drugged out. They're lazy. They don't want to work. They, you know, collect welfare, get drunk, make babies. Let them shoot each other, he says. And then, after a brief pause, he turned to me and said with faux sincerity, I think the problems here are caused by social conditions, which can be solved by better education. I can't tell if that's a healthy cynicism or...
I think it's inevitable
just the way
cynicism.
It is. Inevitable cynicism. Maybe so.
I mean, I became more cynical as well. And I don't think I changed that much. I mean, maybe I wasn't there long enough to change that much. I wish more academics would do research that actually involved talking to people and going places. There's a certain reality to the street that you're not going to get from just looking at the stats about poverty and so on.
Peter Moskos, please stand by. Peter Moskos' new book is Cop in the Hood, My Year Policing Baltimore's Eastern District, Harvard-trained sociologist who was on the beat. You can join our conversation. What's the big lesson on American policing and police we can take away from Peter Moskos' story? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. 911 is a mama.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the Museum of Science Boston and the National Academy of Engineering, committed to promoting engineering and technological literacy in grades K to 12 nationwide, mos.org/NCTL. And Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning patients worldwide short implants, avoiding the need for many bone grafting procedures. Bicon.com.
This is WBUR and WBUR.org. Coming up at noon, it's Here and Now with Robin Young. Republican presidential hopeful John McCain is campaigning on health care reform this week, but he's being overshadowed by the Democratic nomination battle between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. We check in on the race. Also, in the wake of the Reverend Wright brouhaha, can the Obama campaign go back to its early message of unity? That's Here and Now, coming up at noon here on WBUR. You can listen to segments of your favorite WBUR programs when it's convenient for you. Just go to WBUR.org and click on podcast to download portions of WBUR's Morning Edition, On Point, Here and Now, and Only a Game. That's WBUR.org and click on podcasts.
WBUR supporters include Chelsea Clock, an American tradition of clock craftsmanship since 1897. Unique gifts of distinction for generations to enjoy. More at ChelseaClock.com. And Good Food Cafe Cambridge, serving panini, salads, smoothies, and more. Corporate catering options at JimsGoodFood.com. Discover something a world away.
We're on the other end of the shark, so when he hooks up, we're going
to
be circled.
Here comes one. Here comes one right for you, Jen. You got him. You got him.
Or a little closer to home.
So here we are in the men's room of the Smokehouse restaurant.
My, the acoustics are good in here.
Go to places your radio has never gone before.
Join us. On NPR's Day to Day.
Today at 3 on WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about what one Harvard-trained sociologist saw when he climbed out of that ivory tower and into the squad car. Peter Moskos joined the police force in the city of Baltimore in the process of doing the research for his Ph.D. He was a Baltimore City police officer in 1999 into 2001, 6 months in the Baltimore Police Academy, 14 months patrolling the city's very tough eastern district. He's author of the new book, Cop in the Hood, My Year Policing, Baltimore's Eastern District, due out in just a couple, 3 weeks here. And it is a good read. We want to hear more about 9-11, 9-1-1, I should say, the war on drugs. I want to get to a couple of callers here, if I may, first. Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Jonathan, you're on the air with Peter Moskos.
Hi, Peter and Tom. How are you guys doing today?
We're good. What do you know, Jonathan?
Good. I have a kind of a lighthearted question. My girlfriend is probably about to become a police officer in New Haven, Connecticut, which is a bigger city. What advice would you have for a potential rookie?
Is she headed into the academy or headed into the job?
I'm headed into the academy.
Okay, Peter, what do you say? New Haven, Connecticut. She's headed in.
I say congratulations. I wish every all police officers got paid more. I would say pace yourself. Don't go into, as I said, you're not going to change the world, but you can change, individual lives and make the neighborhood safer. Most police departments are kind of screwed up organizations. You're not going to go into, there are going to be problems. The paperwork is overwhelming. You're going to deal with, idiots in the department. But if you can deal with that, and you know it's coming, and can sort of approach it with a sense of humor or a healthy cynicism, it can be a great job.
You say you wish they were paid more. What did you make going in as a rookie policeman in Baltimore?
Maybe $28,400 in 1999.
$28,400 for a job where you carried a gun and put your life on the line.
Wow. Yeah, and I quit at $32,000 in 2001. I'm not certain. I think now the starting salary there is about $35,000. You're not going to get rich as a police officer. I mean, in New York, the starting salary now is still $28,000 for the first 6 months. I mean, to some extent, you get what you pay for, and it's very short-sighted. I mean, along with sort of the fairness that cops do to just deserve to get paid more.
Yeah.
In the long run, despite what they say, standards are going to lower because they got to recruit other police officers. And in the long run, it only takes one expensive lawsuit to sort of counteract any temporary savings and money now.
You also point out, you say fresh out of the police academy, rookie police are usually placed straight into high crime districts because those are the least desired postings for police.
Partly because it's least desired, partly because that's where you learn the fastest. I mean, I wasn't a cop for long, but if you're only going to be on the street for 14 months, you might as well do it in the Eastern District in Baltimore, because I felt I could handle anything after that period of time. But there is a greater problem, which is these districts are not where police want to work because, the working conditions are worse there. And this is where you need the best police officers because it's, and by and large, it can be the toughest place to police. So there is a bit of a problem there.
Tell us about the Eastern District of Baltimore. What characterizations or numbers will explain it to us?
Well, one of the my fears of my book is that it probably will not help the reputation of Baltimore, the Eastern District, and I do love Baltimore, and I think it's a great city, and there are great parts of the Eastern District. But as a police officer, again, I wasn't dealing with the great parts that much. I call it a ghetto because which is offensive to many people because it has certain connotations, but that was the language used by police officers, and that was the language used by the people we policed. But I think people outside of a ghetto think of it as a geographic area, and people in what I call a ghetto think of it as in terms of class and behavior and character. So you can be, just because you're in the ghetto doesn't mean you got to act ghetto. So it's not, you know, like everywhere, there's a lot going on in the Eastern District. But on the bad side, the level of violence, the level of public drug dealing is really unbelievable. One of the things that surprised me as a cop was just how many people were getting shot there. And if you don't live there and you don't work there, you don't hear about it. The murders barely make the newspapers. The people who get shot and live, you know, often don't. So for all practical purposes, if you're never there, it doesn't matter. And I think that's part of the problem. One of the sort of gee whiz statistics in my book, and I'm still waiting for someone to prove me wrong, and it hasn't happened yet, but according to the number of deaths and the census data, if you're born a man in East Baltimore, which means you're born a black man, there's over a 10% chance you're going to get murdered in your lifetime.
Wow.
I mean, that is, and that doesn't even take out of the picture the people who aren't in the game and, you know, whose, you know, parents are raising them right, because they're not going to get murdered. It's the people on the corners, the drug dealers. And that is just, it's at some level, it's unconscionable that we as a, you know, a rich, powerful country don't do more to stop this.
People not in the game, you say. It was interesting in the book you point out that there are all kinds of class distinctions and positions within the community you were in. The game, I guess by that you mean
the drug game.
Street life drug game. And you say some of the strongest encouragement that you saw, that you got to be tough, maybe even to, you know, to get physical and be harsh, came from local residents who were sick of that.
Yeah, I mean, the sort of, you know, old grandpa, pops would be there, and, you know, he wanted us to beat the stuffing out of the people on the corner, which we didn't do. But, you know, he's the guy that lives there. And I went home every night to a different neighborhood. You know, I lived in Greektown in Baltimore. So I didn't, to a certain extent, I didn't have to take it personally. But it's the good residents who live there that really are sort of in a tough place. And a lot have left. I mean, part of the problem with neighborhoods such as the neighborhoods that comprise the Eastern District, it's just flight. Between 1990 and 2000, 30% of the population left.
Wow.
People who can leave generally do eventually. You know, even if you're not in the game, it's one thing, but, you know, the crime scene tape comes up again and you can't get your car going out of work, or a bullet, you know, flies through your window, or you're just harassed walking down the street by you know, 15 to 20-year-old guys who just aren't nice people.
Jonathan, good luck to your girlfriend headed into the force in New Haven, Connecticut. Let's get a call from West Haven, Connecticut. Steve, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. And I've been listening to the to your show, and you touched upon the terrible thing that happened in New York with Mr. Mm-hmm. Bell. And mm-hmm. this doesn't exactly apply, but I often wonder about this, being a civilian, is how people act when they're approached by an officer. And I'd like to, you know, just quickly tell a story of it. Something that happened to me about 30 years ago. I had arranged to meet a friend. You know, he lived in town, in one town. I lived in another town.
Yeah.
And he said, meet me at my mother's house because it's like a midpoint. I drove there. I got there first, and I knew his mother was at work.
Yeah.
And I just parked in front of the house and waited and waited. And all of a sudden, a police officer pulled up behind me. And just like 15 seconds later, my friend pulled right into his mother's driveway. And I said, oh, good, now I have an explanation, you know. And I was watching the officer approach me in my side view mirror, and I put my hand on my door handle, and I started to open my door as if to get out and say, it's okay, officer, I'm just here to meet, you know. And I saw him unsnap his holster and put his hand on his gun, and I just said, whoa, stop. And I just froze, and ever since, and I thought about that. And I, you know, I went away and pondered that, and ever since then, if I, you know, get pulled over in a traffic violation or a spot check or anything, I just roll my window down before he gets there, and then I put both of my hands on the steering wheel.
Yeah. Steve, let us turn that around and hear it from Peter Mosco's perspective.
Rule number one would be keep your hands where I can see them, because that's what I'm concerned about. If I can see your hands, then I'm not going to be scared, because I can see what the threat is. Beyond that, the rules, I think, in dealing with a police officer are the rules you would deal with anybody. Anytime you walk into a store or deal with strangers, just be polite. cops, by and large, are not looking for trouble on a routine stop. It's their job. They just want to do their job.
But what's going through that police officer's mind as he sees Steve sitting parked along the curb? I mean, is that so suspicious? He's got the gun on snap.
Well, no, he got the gun on snap because it was a sudden movement. I mean, parked on the curb, but, you know, good cop says, yeah, what are you doing here? It wasn't a problem yet, but it would be remiss if you just drove by that and, you know, and then later there was some incident happened there. I mean, that's what police do. They're trying to look for things that are out of the ordinary suspicious. That in itself isn't a problem. It's the sudden movements and what are you going to do? Because it's, if you're reaching for a gun, I mean, that's the first thing a police, unfortunately, that's the first thing a police officer is thinking about is their safety. Sudden movements make a cop scared.
Two things you came out pretty despairing on, 911, 911 calls and the whole dynamic of structuring police work around 911 calls. And the other, the war on drugs. Hit those two for us.
I'll start with the war on drugs first, because I think that's to understand policing, especially in a high crime, high drug area. It's all about the war on drugs. There's a good organization called LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, of former and some current prosecutors and judges and police officers who advocate legalizing drugs, and I'm a member of that organization. I think we have to, I don't want to legalize drugs to make it a free for all. I think drugs are bad. The problem is now it is a free for all. You got to regulate the distribution. By and large, people don't get high and shoot each other. The shooting happens because of the drug trade. It's the drug trade violence, and also a culture that comes out of that drug trade that leads to the violence. Simply put, the war on drugs doesn't work. We've got to do something better. I don't have the answer to everything. But
what does it lead to in the day in and day out work of policing a neighborhood like East Baltimore?
What it leads to, it leads to the violence in the neighborhood. And from a policing standpoint, it leads to this just constant, you're chasing the radio calls. I know there's drug dealing. You know, there's drug dealing at the corner of Wolf and Eager, though I think that's been torn down now. That's not news to me. I know the question is, what as a police officer can I do about it? And the truth is, I can't do very much. It's like putting out little brush fires, but you don't get to the heart of the problem. What it prevents police from doing is being more proactive, of walking foot, of actually getting to know people. Also, the war on drugs leads to arrests and incarceration, and the fact that we have 2 million people in prison. I mean, more than any other country in the world, by numbers and by rate. This is because of the drug war, and it doesn't have to be that way. That's what I think people forget.
You also write about in the Eastern District in Baltimore something like, if I got this right, 45,000 people, 25,000 arrests a year, and you write about police arresting, policemen arresting maybe 10 times more than others, a phenomenon that you call collars for dollars. What's that about?
Yeah, that's a New York term. We don't use the term in Baltimore, but cops everywhere know the concept, which is you get money when you arrest people. You don't get paid for the arrest, but you do get paid for going to court. You get court overtime pay. And cops who want to make court overtime pay, cops who want to go to court make a lot of arrests, and cops who don't. And even in a high arrest squad in a high arrest district, there's a huge variance in my squad between cops who are making, you know, a dozen arrests a month and cops who are making none.
Are these bad arrests if it's a dozen, or are they, 12 good arrests?
We
should all be happy.
In the police world, all arrests are good.
Well, what does that mean?
Arrests are good. That's how cops are judged.
Yeah, but I mean, everybody knows you could make an arrest that really disrupts something important, serious, or you can make one that's kind of marginal and
in the police world, all arrests are good. Mm. But that's the point. Maybe from a societal level, maybe we don't want these arrests to be happening. A lot of these arrests are up to the police officer discretion.
I mean, make arrests that are illegitimate, that are essentially harassment.
No, I'm assuming they're all legitimate.
Okay. Are they? If it's collars for dollars?
If drugs are illegal and you arrest someone for drugs, yeah, it's a legitimate arrest.
Okay.
But you don't, as a cop, you don't have to go out on the corner, searching for addicts to lock up. It's a question of how sort of personally you want to take the war on drugs. I mean, for serious crimes, you got to lock people up. There's no doubt.
Yep.
But it's these low-level drug arrests that are the discretionary one. In New York, they use disorderly conduct a lot. In Baltimore, it's loitering. These sort of catch-all arrests, which basically means, you don't do what the cop says.
Sounds pretty discretionary. Sounds like it's open to abuse, though it's also the sort of the broken window theory, right? Fix it quick.
Well, no, because it doesn't come out of a greater problem-solving approach. It could be a strategy. But in general, it's just the idea that arrests are good, and the more arrests, the better. And I think that's part of the problem.
And 911, it drove you crazy. You write that it sort of gets everything backwards.
Yeah, I mean, you need rapid response for ambulances and fire trucks, but for police officers, there's very little that is actually in progress. You end up picking up the pieces after the fact, and about half of police departments are dedicated to patrol and to basically answering radio calls. It's a huge waste of resources. The public generally wants foot patrol. It's the police departments that are sort of resisting that. But we you know, that's a question of will. It's not really a question. We have the police officers. It's a question of what do we want to do with them. But we sold the public on the idea that whenever you pick up the phone and the cops will be right there. But anyone who needs police sort of knows that it doesn't work. That's part of the problem. When you really need cops and you pick up the phone, you might be waiting 5, 10, or 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. Both because the cops are busy and they're just problems in getting the police officer out. Sometimes I pull up in seconds and they say, "Where were you? I called 20 minutes ago." And I say, "Well, what can I do? I just got the call." But there are very few calls that are in progress. And what you lose is that ability to get out of your police car to do things that might actually prevent crime before it happens. That's what the focus of police has to be.
You dedicate the book, we've just got a minute here, but you dedicate it to Crystal Sheffield, who went to police academy with you. To her and 9 other Baltimore City police officers who were killed in the line of duty since you served, including your friend Crystal. What happened?
She was backing up an officer and got into a car crash and died. She was the first woman to, first female police officer in Baltimore to die in the line of duty. I was there at a particularly bad time. When I was there, in the short time I was there, 5 police officers were killed. Luckily, it slowed down a little bit, but yeah, it's a dangerous job.
Peter Moskos, we're glad you went out and did it. We hope it sticks with you lifelong and makes you a better student and scholar of the whole business. Thanks for the on the street experience and for sharing it.
My pleasure. And there's a blog at copinthehood.com if people want to read more about it.
Great, copinthehood.com. The book is Cop in the Hood: My Year Policing Baltimore's Eastern District, and please give our best regards to your father.
I will. Thanks so much.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, Chelsea Mayers, Tanya Rally, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and John Wibby, with help from Jamie Katsoufis and Ping Wong. Our senior producer is Wen Stevenson. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Loomis Sayles, researching and investing for institutions and individuals with a sustained commitment to giving back to the community. More at loomissayles.com. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting Games for Health, using video games to promote health innovations at rwjf.org/pioneer.
This is WBUR and WBUR.org. Coming up next, it's Here and Now with Robin Young. And later today on All Things Considered, the anatomy of a stump speech. Democratic presidential candidate Barack Obama has revamped his stump speech in recent days. We'll take a look at the changes. That's All Things Considered at 4 on WBUR.
WBUR supporters include the Graduate School of Library and Information Science at Simmons, championing access to information in library projects worldwide and across America, simmons.edu. Weston Nurseries in Hopkinton, climate-tested plants, professional advice, and landscape design since 1923. Weston Nurseries, because life is better in the garden. And Boston Ballet's Swan Lake, set to Tchaikovsky's beautiful score, May 1st to 11th, only at City Performing Arts Center, Wang Theater. Details at bostonballet.org.
My favorite was Northeastern, but financial issues came into play with that, and I ended up choosing UMass Amherst.
I'm Monica Brady-Meyerov. This week on Radio Boston, it's college decision time, and we'll look at how the credit crunch and the weak economy are affecting college choice.
I think this year, more than any other year, financial consideration was probably the number one priority.
That's Radio Boston, Fridays at 1 on WBUR.
From Boston University, this is 90.9 WBUR-FM Boston and 1240 WBUR-AM.